Hello, and welcome to the Cancer Horizons podcast. In each episode, you'll hear from patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, or healthcare professionals to do what CURE does best: provide cancer updates, research, and education. Dr. Dawn Musalem, a lifestyle medicine and integrative breast cancer specialist at the Robert and Monica Jacoby Center for Breast Health at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, is a cancer survivor, a recipient of both bone marrow and heart transplants, a mother, and a marathon runner. When she was 26 and in the early months of medical school, Musalem began experiencing shortness of breath and fatigue. One doctor told her she had asthma, another concurred, and a third said it was all in her head. A few days later, she collapsed on her way home from class. She was in cardiogenic shock and her heart wasn't pumping. Doctors found a 16-centimeter mass in her chest wrapped around her heart that had collapsed her left lung. She was diagnosed with stage 4 large diffuse B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and she was told she had 3 months to live if she didn't start treatment immediately. Surgery, chemotherapy, and a bone marrow transplant followed, and life continued for her. She began her career in medicine, gave birth to a daughter who's now 19, and 3 weeks later, began experiencing heart failure. Musalem spent 18 years in heart failure. During that time, she stayed as active as possible, worked with her patients, and volunteered at the National Marathon to Finish Breast Cancer, operated by the Donna Foundation, an organization which financially assists and supports patients with breast cancer and funds breast cancer research. The heart transplant happened in February of 2021, and exactly 1 year to the day later, Musalem crossed the marathon's finish line. In this episode of the Cancer Horizons podcast, Musalem talks with CURE about her Donna Marathon training experience, her connection with her patients, and the importance of physical activity for patients during their cancer recovery.
Yeah, it was exactly 365 days, exactly a year. And, you know, it was so hard because my whole life I was into physical fitness. I studied exercise physiology at undergraduate degree. I went to the Cooper Institute to do research. I studied centenarians running marathons, 100-year-olds running marathons after undergraduate studies, and then went on to medical school. And so I always ran, like from seventh grade, I was running on the weekends, 10 miles, 14 miles. I just loved to run. And so I remember when I was diagnosed with cancer, you know, it was getting hard for me when they didn't know it was cancer. They told me I had asthma. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is the worst. Like, how am I going to live like this? So when I had cancer, it was kind of like, oh good, they can cure this cancer and I can get back to my life. Well, then, you know, 2 years later, I get heart failure. I'm like, this is not good. This is far worse than asthma. So I remember, you know, working here in the breast center with my breast cancer patients and volunteering at the Donna Marathon because I couldn't run. I couldn't walk it with the heart failure. And I remember just thinking, oh my gosh, I would give anything one day to be able to run this. If or when I get a transplant, that'll be good enough to do that. That's what's so hard about heart failure in young people is because it's like, I've used this word, it kind of shackles you, kind of like, you know, it puts your life on hold. I still had wonderful vitality and I still love the essence of life, but I wasn't able to do some of the things that I really enjoyed, and that was physical activity. And then the last year that I had volunteered at the Donna Marathon was, gosh, it was probably like 2018, I think, because I had started to get so sick. My daughter was in high school and she came with me. And I was so sick at that point that I couldn't even hand the cups to the patients. Like, I was getting so dizzy just from using my arms and I couldn't really even cheer. So that was the last time I volunteered, but I remember thinking, okay, I know the transplant's coming sooner at this point because I was so unwell that leading up to my transplant, I told my colleagues, I'm going to run the Donna Marathon. They're like, oh, you mean the half marathon? I'm like, no, I think I want to do the full marathon. So after my transplant, you know, it was pretty quick that I took my first steps. It was like within that first day that I was extubated, and I couldn't believe how hard that first step was. My surgery was pretty complicated. So I had, and leading up to the surgery, I was so decompensated and deconditioned and relied on supportive therapies in the hospital before my transplant. So those first steps were so hard. And I thought, oh, maybe my colleagues, this is what they were talking about. There's no possible way to run a marathon at the 1 year mark. And so I worked with my surgeon because my cardiac rehab team was like, it's not safe to start running at 6 weeks after a heart transplant. Your wound can dehisce and open up. So I talked to my surgeon. He's like, you know, I think if we're smart about this, we can let you run sensibly. So he let me start running very early. So I started running 6 weeks after my transplant, which was super cool. I ran my first 5K at 3.5 months. And what the secret was for me is to have these little micro goals along the way with little small organized races, because it gave me a target. So I ran my first 5K at 3.5 months. And then I did another one at 4 months. And then, you know, just kept on doing these races. And then as my miles started to increase, one of our cardiologists, who's a sports cardiologist at Mayo, said, all right, I'm going to run with you because I want to have eyes on you. I want to make sure you look okay when you're doing this. So he ran a 10 mile race with me and he about killed me. He ran me so hard. I was like, oh, I don't run this hard. I think it was my fastest run ever. But like, even to this day, I can't run that hard. I thought I was going to die. So they had the cardiologist run with me. He had like all these little devices on me. He exercise physiologist ran with me. And then another very advanced runner ran with me. So all three of them are watching me this whole 10 miles. It was like, pressure is on. This is October. So this is like 8 months after my transplant. And then from there, I knew I would be able to run the Donna Marathon because I had did that 10 minutes at a pretty darn good pace, actually. So I trained really sensibly. I'm on a whole food plant-based diet. That was critical. I do not think I would have been able to have the recovery I needed. You're on a lot of medications with heart transplant. And so all the toxicities of those medicines, the only way I could really manage the side effects of those therapies, I think, is because of my diet. Every heart transplant patient has a lot of grit, you know, but the difference between me and them is the nutrition. And that's what attained me that vitality to run the marathon. So it felt amazing to run it. But I had to really be committed to my exercise regimen. I had to really listen to my body. I totally detached many times to social media because I needed the sleep I knew I needed. I really tried during those, when those miles got up there, to do at least 7 hours a night of sleep. And Jeff Galloway trained me. He is the most loving, kind human being ever. And he was so generous with his time and interest to really make sure that my training regimen was appropriate given my past history. So without him, it wouldn't have been possible either. And he is just such a wonderful gentleman that I think really gives, that powerful message that you can do this after or even during some of these, you know, health conditions that people may experience, like cancer or heart disease, which is something that's special to him and his personal life as well that he shares. So yeah, so it was pretty remarkable. And the support from my family and my friends, and my colleagues especially, was just exhilarating. And so it's been super cool since this time, because patients and people from around the world reach out to me and they ask me to help them with their training regimens. Like, how do I do this, you know? And so it's really exciting to be able to represent that, hey, this is possible. You don't have to say no because it's what the norm is.
How do you feel your history as a patient informs, shapes, influences your day-to-day interactions with your patients now? Because yeah. You are someone who has been in the same shoes, standing in the same spot that they are now. How do you think your personal history informs the way you work with people who are in their own very difficult health journeys?
Yeah. Well, Mayo Clinic's been very supportive to let me really do what is my passion and purpose. And that's, you know, practicing lifestyle medicine in the cancer center, where I get to work with people with how they live their life during and after cancer treatment. And, you know, going through what you go through, it really gives you the ability to connect with people. It's such a gift, that ability to connect and really kind of be able to have a good sense or intuition, if you may, of where they're at in their cancer journey. And just to be able to be there with them in that time of vulnerability. And so it's given me the ability to like have a good pulse on exactly where I need to be with the patient. And whenever I start that visit with my patients, I always ask them, you know, what are your goals? What do you want me to help you with? And a lot of them don't know my story. And I don't always share it with my patients unless I feel like it's going to change the overall dialogue and give them support, because all of our journeys are so different. And I came from this very loving, supportive family. I mean, gosh, like the thing that really is the hardest is when people don't have that love in their life. And I have a lot of that. My family is so loving. So for me, I think the biggest obstacle for most people is an obstacle that I never had to even contend with. So I'm very sensitive. I think I have very good emotional intelligence going through everything I've gone through, because I did get to interact with a lot of doctors that didn't. So man, I learned what I needed to learn in medical school, and I had wonderful mentors that taught me the knowledge of what I need to do. And so I'm very proud to have that strong evidence-based and intellect behind supporting what I do. But the art of medicine truly came from being a patient. And that's phenomenal. And, you know, I hope no one has to go through what I went through, but there is a gift that lies within that. And it's a beautiful, remarkable gift. It allows me to enjoy life to a degree that most people aren't aware of, the preciousness of that life every second. And then it really allows me to have that special relationship with my patients and to know how to guide them. And then once they give me kind of their goals to kind of navigate through what I think is most important for them at that time. And I would say probably about 90% of what I do is the whole food, plant-based nutrition and helping to empower patients about the importance of just that. And in physical activity too. And really when it comes to breast cancer, physical activity is the most robust aspect of, at least behind the science in breast cancer survivorship, but it's all of those facets of lifestyle medicine that matter most. For me, I think what matters most for a breast cancer survivor is social connections, horizontal, like us having this wonderful exchange, as well as vertical, so belief in something bigger than us, and that spiritual core to fill that. I think that hands down is the most important aspect, believing in something bigger than ourselves. And if we believe in something bigger than ourselves, we're not quite as fearful of our mortality. We're not paralyzed and crippled by it. We're kind of empowered by it, if you may. You know, we're empowered by the sense that, yes, I do have this finite time on earth. And so therefore I must embrace my time on earth, my aliveness. So I really think that that connectedness is very critical. And then the purpose in one's life, the why. And so if I can establish both of those things, I know I have a really good foundation and support to get that person to be successful with their whole food plant-based nutrition. But if someone doesn't have a really big why, and there's no bigger why than, oh, you have cancer. So I'm quite selfish. I generally don't want to work with someone who doesn't have a major disease because they usually just, they're not as interested to make these lifestyle changes, which with such like deep, genuine desire to make that change. So in these women with breast cancer, which is mainly what I work with, those strong reasons why they want to change that lifestyle really helps to support them in that healthy eating. It's exciting. I had two women this week. One is metastatic, stage 4. She has no evidence of her disease remaining. She's on a whole food plant-based diet. I'm not saying that's why she has no evidence of disease. It's a combination of things, right? But she is vital. She's in her late 60s. She has lost 60 pounds on her whole food plant-based diet. It's incredible. Her significant other is a liver transplant patient, and he's now also my patient. I made an exception to see him. And he is a liver transplant patient, and he too is whole food plant-based. They are the most fun people to visit with, but they have just done so well. And I had another woman this week, so she's a little earlier on in her cancer journey, and she's not metastatic, but she's advanced, locally advanced, and she's lost 50 pounds. And so I asked her this week, I said, you know, tell me, like, how do you feel? How do you feel right now? You're still undergoing treatment with your cancer compared to how you felt before treatment. She's like, I feel better. That's so cool. It is so cool to help people feel better during cancer treatment, like to really pivot and use that cancer as a teacher of life to get them to live healthy and to see that flourishing. If that message could just get out to everyone, we could have just such a beautiful life for everyone. But a lot of people aren't willing to make those changes. And it's not a sacrifice. I get these messages and people are like, gosh, I'm not dieting. I'm eating this healthy, beautiful food. But I think a lot of it comes to nutrition. I think there's such vibrancy to it. And I think when we eat food that's, you know, from the earth, it's the kind of the compassionate thing to do. It's the loving thing to do. It's better for our environment, but it's just so good to nurture the body in that way. And I think it energizes the body because you are eating food that has more ability to do such a thing.
Absolutely.
That's a little woo-woo medicine. That's my belief. Yeah, it's cool. Cool. Oh, and my patients look great. They're running 5Ks. I have women doing half marathons on chemotherapy. I'm like, ooh, I know. I can't believe this. Either I am just getting really lucky or it's just this recipe is great. So it's been wonderful. It's so good to be healthy because for 18 years, I wanted to do what I did. And I did do a degree, but I had to hold back because I knew I only had so much to give. And now I can just give and give and give because I feel great. I got to get rid of my energy. So I'm giving. So it's good.
Now to what you just said about how you did what you could, but you could only give so much to a point prior to the transplant. How important, in your opinion, is it for folks to be active and be engaged with their own body to whatever degree they're physically capable of when they are going through, a health crisis, a health journey?
I think it's so crucial, Alex. And I remember when my heart failure had gotten so severe and it was getting hard to even really spend time with my daughter, that my cardiologist said, "I think you need to get a handicap sticker." I was like, "Oh, I will never get a handicap sticker." There were a few times I thought like, "Oh, it'd be really nice to have a handicap sticker right now," but I refused because I thought that activity was so important. And so for me, I wasn't doing formal exercise at the end, but I still stayed active. You know, I did as many things as I could. And I even tried to go do, you know, restorative yoga and those sorts of things just to give me a little bit more of a formal, enjoyable form of exercise during that time. But you have to show up for yourself. You know, you should really try to show up to yourself before you get the disease, because we know that 42% of cancers, according to the American Cancer Society, are preventable. So let's show up for yourself before you even get the disease, if you can, because if you don't show up for your healthcare, you're going to show up for your sick care, you know? But then once you're sick, I mean, we learn, and we know with physical activity, it helps reduce the adverse effects of treatment, and it helps reduce dying from cancer. So it's critical that our cancer survivors exercise. And if it's not exercise, it doesn't need to be exercise. Just move your body. And that's what I tell my women during treatment. I push hard on my patients to move. And I just had a talk with a woman yesterday. I said, "Listen," and her husband was there. And she has stage 4 cancer. I mean, so I can get away with these conversations, right? Because I just share with them, like, "You're gonna have to push, because right now you're not feeling good and you're not exercising at all and you're sleeping all day. So I need you to sleep less." I said, "You're gonna set the alarm, 15 minute naps, that's it. You're getting 8 hours of sleep each night and you're sleeping straight through. So you're getting great sleep. So 2 15-hour or 15-minute naps. And then I want you to do at least a 5 minute walk in the morning, 5 minutes in the afternoon, and 5 minutes night." The husband said, "Guess what? We just bought her a bike." I said, "Even better. If you don't want to walk because it's hot, then get on that bike for 5 minutes. And you know what's going to happen is once you do 5 minutes, you'll be able to probably do 5 minutes more. I bet you can get 10. So I really try to get them to get that 30 minutes in a day, and they can break it up. And if they don't want to do the bike or they don't want to walk, I have them clean or full of clothes. You know, just do something that will keep your body moving. I like for my patients and myself included, I'm not at home right now, but usually when I'm on these calls, I'm always standing because I love that movement. And so I have my patients who are doing desk jobs to set their alarms for every hour and get up and stand or move at place at your desk for at least 3 minutes during that time. So the movement is so important just to re-energize us. And we know that that physical activity during treatment gives us back energy. So I use that as a, you know, kind of a guide. I do push hard, and that's a lot of times when I bring my history of cancer up, because they understand why I'm pushing a little bit more. I never want a patient to think I'm being insensitive. And sometimes I'll preface it with that. "Listen, this may seem that I'm being insensitive to where you're at with your treatment, but this really matters. And I want you just to try it because I think you'll feel better." So that voice for me to be a little firm for the patient comes from the fact that I've been there. And I love that I can be firm, because sometimes that's what it takes. And there's this beautiful analogy that when the heart beats, it keeps 5% of the blood for itself before it can serve the rest of the body. And if the heart didn't keep 5% of the blood for itself, it couldn't do all these things it does for the body. And so that is an example I share with women, because, you know, a lot of these young cancer survivors I see, they don't have time for formal exercise, but they're active all day long. But maybe they don't have time to get healthy food, or maybe they don't have time to get the sleep they need. I really talk to them about the fact that, listen, you've got to show up for yourself, and it's okay to be vulnerable and to get help from others so that you can show up for yourself. Because if you don't, you're not going to be able to keep serving everyone around you like you currently are.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cancer Horizons podcast or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cancer Horizons podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. Find us on Facebook at Cure Today, Twitter at Cure_Today, and Instagram at Cure Today.